Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today nearly live. We are in New Orleans, Louisiana, here at the American Culture Association, or Popular Culture Association, annual conference. And we are back after our little two-month break from the show. We just wanted to refresh and get some new stuff in. And I'm very excited to come back with this particular episode because it's something that I'm really interested in, something that I was really interested in as a kid and now I've sort of fallen back into a little bit, and that's professional wrestling, and something that I don't think gets a lot of credit as an art form, as a means of storytelling. So I'm really interested to talk to our guest today, AJ Ortega from the University of Houston, Victoria, who is a lecturer in English and is a creative writer, and his academic interests are in researching professional wrestling. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sean. Thanks for having me. And I liked your intro about wrestling not getting the credit it deserves or just getting kind of knocked for really strange reasons. You know, it's always, you know, you bring up professional wrestling and you get one canned argument immediately, which is, I'll let you fill in the blank. What do you think that argument is?
Well, it's not real.
Oh, there you go.
It's
right?
Not
oh,
real.
Oh, my God, Sean.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You're blowing my mind now. And what will I ever do with my... Yeah, you know, so that's the problem that we run into. And my answer to that problem is, well, yeah, people say, well, wrestling's fake. And I'm like, well, no, unicorns are fake. Wrestling is quite real, you know? The argument that it's fake means that, or that it's not real, or that it's scripted even, that makes it lose credibility is quite foolish, I think, quite foolish, because, you know, I'll ask people, I'll say, okay, so you're not into wrestling because it's fake. That's cool. What TV shows do you watch? And they're like, oh, I watch Game of Thrones. Oh, that's a good show. I was like, I don't have to explain to you that those people aren't actually cutting each other's heads off.
Right.
You know, I like Breaking Bad. I love that show too, but I don't have to go explaining to people that Bryan Cranston is not really a meth dealer.
Yeah.
And so why does that argument not work in any other facet of entertainment? Well, it only, that's the kind of go-to for wrestling, and it's just getting kind of tired, and it's getting kind of just kind of blown out of proportion. And what I aim to do is to, you know, bring this academic scholarship side to it, to give credibility to it and get it the respect that it deserves. We'll probably get into it later, but I've actually, you know, spent some time, a little bit of time, I won't say I'm an expert by any means, but refereeing on the independent circuit and hanging out with those guys. Like, yeah, they deserve all the credit in the world, and they do deserve respect just like anybody else that, you know, performs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where the angle I'm coming from.
Right, and I think it's because it is. That whole fake thing is so weird because, you know, Harrison Ford didn't actually have a giant boulder go over him.
Right.
It's a character and it's a show, and I think... And when you look at the guys, it's what they can do. Like, it's very athletic. And then you hear stories about someone like Mick Foley.
Sure.
If you don't know who Mick Foley is, just Google or go to YouTube and put in Mankind, Undertaker, King of the Ring. I think it's 1998.
Right.
Watch what happens to Mick Foley and tell me that that's not real.
Right, certainly.
Right? I mean, these guys take a beating doing this.
Yeah, and it's all for the sake of storytelling, right?
Right.
And so, you know, in that match, you know, Undertaker, you know, certainly the bad guy, he's the heel, as it were, you know, the antagonist, as we would call it in literature, for instance, throwing a guy off a cage onto a table. Well, there's only so many ways you can do that.
Right.
WWE doesn't use special effects, so, you know, that's
yeah.
just, that's not an effect, that's actually a man falling and hurting himself for the sake of a crowd's enjoyment, which is strange, certainly, and Mick Foley is one of the most interesting people and characters, too, you know, he himself and his characters are just fascinating. And a stand-up guy. I will say that I saw one of his stand-up comedy shows over in Victoria. And really, really sweet dude. Got my first edition of his first book signed. So he's a really good guy. Again, he's still doing what he did in the ring now. He's doing stand-up comedy, and it's all narrative-based. He's still telling stories, just not with his body anymore.
Right.
So it's really fascinating. It really is.
So for you, I mean, you're a creative writer by trade, and then you come into this, you're in the English department there in Victoria. Where does this interest then, I mean, you talk a little bit about this legitimizing it, but I mean, how do you get other people on board? I mean, academia can be a very tough world when you're studying mainstream topics.
Oh, sure.
Here's something a little offbeat. I mean, you come into the university, how is this treated by colleagues? And how do you sort of promote yourself as a legitimate academic in something that a lot of people don't view as legitimate?
A lot of it is having this conversation. And saying, well, yeah, wrestling's not real, you know, but lots of the stuff we enjoy aren't real. It's all artifice, you know, we get it. And so that's the angle I take. And another one of the arguments that I'll bring up is, well, I always like pop culture. Yeah, you know, there's enough people studying all these, you know, old texts, you know, medieval texts, Shakespeare, all this, you know, things that English majors that are on the course list, you know, that's all there. And then more recently you get, you know, pop culture studies that incorporate things like, you know, science fiction, which I dabbled into. You know, I did a presentation on the show Lost, you know, about the narrative structure about that. Then I got into talking about storytelling and rap music for a bit. And, that, you know, again, that's pop culture. And so specifically with the hip-hop subculture, that's one I kind of try to compare to wrestling, that hip-hop's very new. It's, you know, late 70s, early 80s, you know, depending on who you talk to. But it's a relatively new subculture, and then rap music being the musical art form for that subculture. Now you got classes about hip hop and rap music, and you study the lyrics, and you read the books, and you take the classes, and so that exists, and that's a very recent thing. Professional wrestling's been around since the turn of the last century, you know, in the early 1900s, you know, it started out. And well, where's that credibility? You know, hip hop got it in no time. You know, and again, they're still kind of fighting that battle, but they're getting there, and they're making something happen. Wrestling, I think, has taken a whole lot longer to get that kind of credibility. My colleagues are all very interested in it, and I've taken some of them to wrestling shows, and you know, they read my work, they support my presentations. Yeah, all my supervisors, bosses, or whatever, as it were, just really really supportive and into this. You know that. Hey, you can say something smart about something that people look at as lowbrow, you know? Mm. And, you know, and you can't forget, I'll quote Chris Jericho, a fellow Canadian, right, of yours. Chris Jericho, he says that, you know, if Shakespeare was still around, he'd be writing for wrestling, you know? Right. It's very much the same model. Mm. Shakespeare was not highbrow. Mm-hmm. No, only now we think it is. It was for the masses. Turn on your TV, 7 o'clock Monday night. There's people performing for the masses with a stage, in a round, you know. So there's a whole lot of parallels there that's what I use to kind of be like, hey, you got to take me a little bit serious because this is the angle I'm coming at, you know. Mm-hmm. So
I guess, though, I mean, you make that parallel to hip-hop, which is really interesting. But I guess the difference that I would point out is that, I mean, hip-hop is within the genre of music and people can understand music, right? Mm-hmm. Professional wrestling, it's not sports.
No,
but it's not pure entertainment in that there's this athletic thing of it. And Vince McMahon created this term of sports entertainment.
Yeah, they move away from the term wrestling.
Wrestling, it's just not this sport, this notion of, I mean, and Vince McMahon comes in, like the younger Vince McMahon comes in and wants to attract families to it and get rid of this notion of, I mean, it bleeds, it leads sort of thing and get into this entertainment part. So it doesn't really fit with anything else, which I guess is kind of what makes it really interesting, but also makes it a little more difficult to study, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, sure, certainly. It is kind of like, man, it's hard to, you know, we're here at this pop culture conference, and I was, you know, for a while I was, you know, do these presentations, and it's you don't know where you fit in this whole. Well, the show comes out on TV. Maybe I go on a television panel. Maybe it's a television studies thing. Well, what if you go to a live event? Sometimes those aren't televised. So is it a television event? And so you have to have that argument. And the truth is that it is all those things. You know, it does incorporate elements of theater, elements of television, elements of actual wrestling. And it does have its roots in the oldest sport, you know, which is true, you know, Greco-Roman wrestling, freestyle wrestling, true mat wrestling. A lot of those roots are there. And now it's just a stylized version of it. So it is its own thing. There really isn't anything that incorporates so many things into one genre. Theater can come close sometimes. Theater can come close, and that's the closest comparison I can make. You know, and so I wasn't a theater scholar or anything like that. So I have a lot of catching up to do because I will have to look at wrestling through this lens. Right. You know, instead of just as solely as a writer, as somebody who tells stories. Which wrestling does do, but it, you know, there's this live aspect, you know, and so it complicates it. It certainly complicates it.
Yeah. So when you look at wrestling, what would you say is the intended audience for a professional wrestling show? Like the WWE, I know there's this interesting divide of like you need kids And there's, I mean, if anyone pays attention to this stuff, like the John Cena debate of like John Cena's character, the older people who are on the internet and writing about it don't like John Cena, but the kids love John Cena and buy all his stuff. And so there's this interesting parallel of like, who is your intended audience? Is it these older guys who have grown up with wrestling and maybe have come back to it, or is it the kids? And for you as a scholar, how do you find, not even understanding that audience, but then understanding your audience who would consume what you're doing?
Yeah, I think you have to look at it in two ways, I think. I'm going to try to get this right. So you got to look at it in two ways. So the part of it is, well, what is the demographic of the people that consume wrestling? And the truth of the matter is the demographic has expanded immensely. Like, you know, we're talking, you know, five-year-old kids to grandparents and everybody in between, right? And especially once you have different types of shows. You have Monday Night Raw, then you have SmackDown, and then you have... now you have NXT, you have the WWE Network. Then they have like WWE cartoons and children's books and action figures. So that demographic is quite big. And so I think wrestling's for everybody. There's something for everybody, you know, because it's not just one giant narrative, but there's also micro narratives within it between certain characters, certain feuds. Some are more family friendly than others, and so on. So there is something for everybody as far as the demographic goes. What I think has changed in wrestling is what they call the psychographic, which is, well, not just who's consuming this stuff, but why are they consuming? What are these maybe cultural impulses that make them flock to wrestling? And the reason people watch wrestling is to be told a story. You know, nobody's watching it to see a legitimate contest. It's the illusion of a legitimate contest. And so, if you look at the psychographic, people are watching wrestling for the same reason, again, they're watching Breaking Bad or Empire or whatever show is going to be on TV, because they want to be told a story. And so anybody that wants to be told an interesting story in an interesting way right before their eyes, that's who wrestling is for.
But there's not a lot of things that then would cross the age gap that a 5-year-old can go watch it and that like a 50-year-old can go watch it. Right. Obviously, they would have different reactions to it.
Sure.
Right. The 5-year-old might think it's real and believe that this is a real fight, and the 50-year-old, you know, would hope that they understand that it's not, and that it's the show, and they are trying to tell the story. But not a lot of stuff bridges that large of a gap that two people of such different ages can really embrace it.
Right. Yeah. I remember, you know, being dragged to go to the Nutcracker. I'm like, now I kind of get it. Now I get it. Now I can go. And now I go to these things. But you know, when I was 6, 7, 8 years, like, well, no. Well, what if, you know, what if the Nutcracker body slams somebody?
Right.
You know, like, well, now the 5-year-old's interested, right? And so, you know, it's like maybe a silly analogy, but I think that really is, you know, part of what wrestling is. You know, that I saw a statistic one time that, you know, in a, I forget if it was a 2-hour show or a 3-hour show, I don't think it really matters, but in a long wrestling show on TV, there's only actually about like 22, 23 minutes of actual wrestling,
right,
like on average, you know, because a lot of it is filled with the, you know, lots of exposition, you know, as it were, to use a literary term, you know, like exposition through promos, backstage segments, you know, things that are shot off site and little video packages and things like that that propel a narrative forward.
Well, I watched the 1,000th episode of Raw, whenever that was, 2, 3 years ago, whenever it was. And I hadn't watched an episode in, I don't know, 10 years, probably. And I turned it on, and I did. I watched the whole thing, and it was 3 hours. And I was shocked at how, I found it slow, was the word I used describing it later, is that, they're talking, and they're trying to forward the storyline, but the crowd is so interactive, which I realize is part of the story and all this, but... it's like it takes them 5 minutes to say 2 sentences.
Right.
So it took so long. And then I was looking back at some old stuff on Wikipedia, like matches, like different cards from pay-per-view events, and looking at the time of the matches. I'm surprised sometimes at how short some of these matches are, like 4 or 5 minute matches, which physically for these guys is a lot, and I understand that.
Sure.
But I remember as a kid, it just always felt longer.
No, it was legitimately longer. You know, there was, I think, less of the video kind of packages, less of the they still had promos and things like that. But the matches, it was a 20-minute time limit was, like, standard. Then you'd get, you know, 30, 40-minute time limits. Then you'd get, you know, hour-long matches, you know, and not just, though, at a certain point it became a gimmick match, you know, the Iron Man match, you know, goes 60 minutes, how many pinfalls or submissions can you get? But, you know, once upon a time, you go back to, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, 60-minute matches in front of a live audience with no TV cameras wasn't uncommon.
Right.
It wasn't uncommon, you know. And you bring in, you bring up the subject of the spectator, which is, again, what makes wrestling unique, that the audience is part of the show.
Yeah.
You don't have a show if you don't have a crowd,
right?
And it seems kind of like, you know, well, that's obvious and stuff. But in wrestling, the crowd is so important that they can even dictate the storylines and stuff, or maybe even you know, mess things up. And so, like, I was just cracking up over the weekend watching a WrestleMania, and they have a Russian character who's a bad guy,
Rusev,
right?
Yeah.
He's just tremendous. He's great, and against John Cena, the All American, you know, really wholesome kind of character. And at a certain point, this kind of like what you mentioned earlier, this anti John Cena fans made it well known that they're, hey, we don't like this guy, and start chanting John Cena sucks and this and that, and cheering for Rusev, which is like, dude came out in a Russian tank, like waving a flag and, you know, and degrading America and all this kind of stuff, which I find entertaining and stuff, you know. It's a, you know, it is a show, you know. I'm smart enough to know, hey, he probably doesn't really mean that and all that stuff.
I believe the guy isn't even from Russia.
No, he's not
the
even
actual
from Russia.
Man,
right, exactly. But it's like, well, how many times do actors play
roles
of people who aren't that ethnicity or race?
Exactly.
And that, and we accept that, though.
Yeah.
We accept, oh, well, they're acting. So okay, well, so's Rusev, you know?
Right.
But the crowd there was like, you know, in a certain way, kind of subverting the storyline they were going for. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, these are the clear good guy and bad guy. It doesn't get more basic than that. That's the oldest story in the book, you know, get the American versus the foreigner.
Yeah.
And this time around, the crowd was like, well, no, we're cheering for the foreigner, even though he's a bad guy, even though he's saying bad things about the USA. And so, and you don't get that, again, when you go to a play. You typically don't get that. You know, you don't get that. Maybe you get a little bit of that, like at a rock concert, you know, something like that. If people chant for a song or chant for an encore. You know, but even then, it's not dictating a narrative. Oftentimes it's not, you know. So, again, wrestling becomes this very unique art form. And I do treat it as an art form.
Yeah. I guess maybe the closest comparison would be maybe stand-up comedy, where there's a heckler there and there's interaction between the comedian and the heckler.
Right, right.
But it's not the same as a crowd of 20,000 people.
Right.
Right? I said to you before, I listen to I don't watch it much, but I do listen to some of the podcasts, like the meta stuff, like talking about backstage and what makes interesting storylines.
Sure.
I find that really interesting. And then how the WWE is responding to their crowd. Mm-hmm. And after the Royal Rumble, I did go back and watch the Royal Rumble match from this year, where the crowd, it's clear who's going to win at about halfway through the match.
Yeah.
And the crowd understands it and boos the whole way.
Yeah.
And it really changes the experience for the viewer watching at home. Like, that level of interaction is really unique.
Right, right. No, it's really interesting. That Royal Rumble, and then leading up to this WrestleMania, with WrestleMania being hyper successful, Royal Rumble, you know, people being very giving a lot of criticism, and I'm always careful, especially ever since I spent some time refereeing on the independent circuit and got a respect for the guys and everything. I try not to be too critical of the product. I mean, I'm not a Vince McMahon. I'm not on their creative writing team. I'm not in the ring taking those bumps and stuff. So I'm like, well, you know, I just kind of watch it for what it is, and then kind of analyze what's there. But that Royal Rumble match was interesting because, yeah, you get to the end, and it should be suspenseful to the end, but then you have one baby face and four heels in the ring, and so you know which way it's going. And, you know, it would be more interesting if you had, you know, all the baby faces in the ring, and then the crowd's like, oh my god, who do I cheer for? I like all these guys.
Right.
And so that, I think, makes for more interesting storytelling. I'm sure they have their reasons for doing it the way they did, which are, you know, probably beyond, you know, my understanding from as an outsider, you know. And so I try not to be, you know, hypercritical of it, because that's one thing that is really interesting on the internet now, is that now all of a sudden, I like to say I'm a wrestling scholar and all this, but I'm certainly not an expert. The wrestlers are the experts. The people that have been doing this stuff their entire lives are the experts. Again, I'm the observer. I have been a participant as a referee, and that's and I have that little angle, that little bit of understanding. But I do try to, you know, avoid the the fanboy that knows everything mentality. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's productive. Again, it's I think we need to move away from that and kind of, you know, have a legitimate argument, legitimate conversation in a smart way, in an intelligent way about the product, like we do about television, like we do about film. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, so.
But I don't know. I don't think the discussion is always intelligent about mm-hmm. television and film. I mean, you go on Twitter and see reactions to stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the stuff sometimes with wrestling is that initial reaction gets overblown. And certainly. because there's not that many people, I assume, like you, mm-hmm. who are engaging in these deeper analytical discussions over it,
yeah.
that initial visceral reaction that some people have on Twitter is the stuff that is being taken as, well, this is the reaction. This is what it is.
Right.
So we don't. Exactly. So there isn't people. There aren't enough people like you doing what you're doing to move beyond that. Because right. with shows like, say, when How I Met Your Mother ended, that initial visceral reaction from people on Twitter was quickly dismissed as people who are seen as more analytical started writing about it. Like, you know, whether it's reviewers or whatever, right? And that when you started to Google. Mm-hmm. The end of the show, that sort of stuff came up as opposed to that initial negative reaction. Mm-hmm. In wrestling, there isn't as much of that second wave of stuff to really break it down.
Yeah, what's interesting when you bring that up, like after WrestleMania, there's a whole bunch of great articles and stuff that were, you know, saying smart things and were praising the product because they did put on a hell of a show and everybody, you know, got their money's worth and everything like that. So I think a lot of times it's, I'm going to say fanboys because they say that in all, you know, all these different realms, but in the wrestling, you know, fanboys, you know, if they don't like it, they become more vocal about it and they start blowing up Twitter and start writing their silly little blogs and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, well, you just didn't like what happened. And so that's why you're being vocal about it because it's not pleasing you. And it's like, well, maybe, you know, again, like just accept it for what it is and try to just kind of roll with it, you know, because there's enough people out there that are anti-wrestling, and it's even coming from its own community and its own consumership, I think, which is, I think, counterproductive. Again, if you want people to stop looking at you strange because you're a wrestling fan, you know, and think you, and you know, and push these certain stereotypes onto you because, oh, this guy watches wrestling, he's this way, and he's dumb, or he's a redneck, or he's unintelligent, or he doesn't, you know, like that's, you know, like you're not doing us any favors, dude, like, you know, chill out with that, you know, and try to show, you know, this art form that you claim to love, at least show it a little bit of respect, you know. And so again, my angle is I can't combat that, I really can't, so my angle is like, well, let me go the academic route and stuff, you know, because Once stuff is put in, you know, in, bound, and has a nice presence in the form of a book artifact, and it goes up on a shelf, it commands a certain amount of authority. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really does, you know. And so that's kind of how I'm trying to combat that, you know.
Yeah.
And there are some good
I mean, there are, but it's not to the same extent.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's a matter of scale.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's disproportion, basically, is what you're saying, and I'm agreeing that. Yeah, in other realms and different modes of entertainment, there is a sort of balance and stuff like that. You know, oh, that was a crappy episode of whatever, so I'm going to be a little bit vocal about it. But with wrestling, I think it's a little bit exaggerated. It's quite lopsided, you know.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, I read a lot of what Dave Shoemaker does at Grantland.
Great, yeah.
And then on major event nights, I know Deadspin sort of does live.
Yeah, Deadspin will pick up some of the stuff.
Some of the stuff. But, I mean, generally speaking, I find it difficult to find well-written quality analysis of the stuff. So, I mean, whereas with TV, it's easier.
Certainly.
There's just more people.
Right.
And when you talk about, like, these people who aren't happy with sort of the results, there's this interesting dynamic, too, is that wrestling doesn't have an off-season.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, you know, with TV, you have that season finale, and there's sort of this build to that. And then wrestling, there's seasons and this notion of everything builds to WrestleMania.
Right.
And you have this refresh on the year.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not quite the same because these storylines, sure, some of the storylines are blown off.
Right.
But some of them continue.
Yeah, some get tied up, but then some of them start at WrestleMania, too.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as one storyline ends, it's like, we have a show tomorrow.
Right.
Like, what's the next step?
Right.
You know, and they're not looking one step ahead. They're looking 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 steps ahead.
Mm-hmm. But to do that, you need the, because in TV, let's be honest, the good guy usually wins.
Right.
Right, whatever it is. He or she falls in love, or they achieve whatever they want to achieve, and everything works out in the end.
Right.
In wrestling, because you don't have that defined end point, the good guy can't always win. Right. So the person who the fan doesn't want to win has to win sometimes to maintain the notion of, or to be able, like, you're suspending disbelief, right? Mm-hmm. So to continue to do that, I think the bad guy has to win sometimes.
Well, yeah,
or the
certainly.
Small guy has to beat the big guy, or whatever it is.
I mean, like, as a storyteller myself, somebody who writes short stories and stuff, creative writing, and so you read a lot of literary theory. And so I started reading, you know, lit theory stuff and found that, I'm going to paraphrase Kenneth Burke, and basically he says you set up an initial condition and you want to promise the audience something, or the reader something in this case, and you deliver the opposite for as long as you can, right? And that's what tension is in a story.
Yeah.
That's what plot is, you know. And then, well, that's what wrestling is, you know. John Cena finally won at WrestleMania against Rusev, but for the past several weeks or months, he had been fighting Rusev and losing, you know. Well, because that builds the tension.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so, yeah, usually the good guy's hopefully going to win at the end. You know, at least, you know, our moral code tells us we want that.
Mm-hmm.
But so long as the WWE delivers the opposite, right, Rusev winning, that keeps you watching week after week, building that tension until you get that denouement, as it were, and wrap everything up and get that closure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it operates under the same pretenses as, you know, how you put together a good story.
So one of the things you mentioned is that, you know, a lot of the times it's good guy versus bad guy, and there's certain stereotypes. Rusev is a good example of the Russian evil character, and it harkens back to Nikolai Volkov and as the USSR guy, the communist guy who comes over, and then he gets converted. And,
all that stuff.
All that fun stuff. And you've written about stereotypes in wrestling, and I think everybody can think of these tropes of, you know, the main, you know, Hulk Hogan guy, and that's sort of passed on now to John Cena as this ultimate American good person. But there's also very negative stereotypes, particularly with women.
Oh yeah,
in professional wrestling, and I'm wondering, is this reliance that professional wrestling seems to have on stereotypes, can it be seen as a negative thing? Not only in the storytelling, but also in the way, you know, viewers then see women, minorities, any sort of disenfranchised group.
I think anytime you're working with stereotypes and things of that nature, it becomes problematic, you know? And I'm not consistent in what I think is okay and what is not, you know? There's TV shows and movies rely on stereotypes a lot, too, because we know what they are, you know?
Right.
I mean, that happens in other genres as well, not exclusive to wrestling, again. Maybe the ones in wrestling are a little bit more pervasive and exaggerated because it's spectacle and because it's this theater thing where you have to be able to see those stereotypes from the nosebleed seats,
right.
You know? I mean,
that's
really part of it, too. So I think they have to be more exaggerated. Yeah, it becomes problematic. Some of the stuff can, I think, maybe go over the line and so on, you know, but it's one of those things that they put out a product for entertainment, and just like any other artist puts out a product, once it's out of your hands, it's up to the viewer or the audience to interpret it accordingly. And, wrestling banks on a lot of gender stereotypes, oftentimes some negative ones. But at the same time, they also defy a lot of gender stereotypes. I mean, the number one, the strongest woman in the company is the boss's daughter, Stephanie McMahon.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, I mean, you hear a lot of stuff like, oh, women in the workplace, for instance, you know, and that glass ceiling. Stephanie McMahon is calling the shots, you know. She's also a heel character and everything.
Yeah.
But she's also the top dog, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And not because of her husband. Her husband, Triple H, is the second, you know, but because he married her, so she, in a certain way, has more power and authority than he does. So in that way, I think, well, that's interesting. Yeah, we'll harp on all the negative stereotypes, but let's look at the ones that are, it's rare, but sometimes they do subvert those stereotypes and something interesting does happen, you know. But again, yeah, they are rare, you know, they're rare.
I mean, but you can say, sure, Stephanie McMahon is in control. To a certain degree. I mean, I think there's still this notion that Vince McMahon...
Well, I mean, her character, I'm sorry.
There. Oh, the character. Okay, yeah, the character.
Stephanie McMahon, the character. Is calling the shots on the show.
Right, yeah. So she's in charge. But at the same time, you know, in a three-hour show, and for whatever reason, Raw is 3 hours, which there's been a lot of complaints about that.
Sure, yeah.
That's too long.
The pacing is a little bit long.
Yeah, but in a 3-hour show, the women's division gets 8 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. Like, so even within that realm, mm-hmm. there's this notion of, well, they're not really getting enough credit. And the I've watched a couple women's matches. These women can do some really good stuff.
Oh, and that's the thing. Like, I just wish from an aesthetic standpoint, like, women's wrestling can... it looks differently. It looks different than two men wrestling.
Yeah.
And I don't mean just because of the body, but because of the movement.
Yeah.
Because of the movement. And it is aesthetically pleasing to see two really good women wrestlers go at it. And you see a lot of great women wrestling in Japan. You see a lot of great women wrestling in Mexico. You see a lot just in the independent circuit in the U.S. and even Canada, I would imagine, you know, and everywhere. Yeah, but once the televised product of the WWE gets a hold of it, it's kind of rare to get that caliber. I don't know what the reasons for that are, but, you know, you get Trish Stratus, a tremendous wrestler, a Gail Kim, a Lita, you know, these very talented, athletic women. Right now you have, you know, AJ Lee and Paige, who are both just tremendous athletes. But you're right, they're not getting a whole lot of screen time. You know, they're kind of, they're totally taking a backseat to the guys. And you know, well, that is problematic, I think. Mm. You know, that is problematic. And oftentimes everything is just reduced to very simple kind of a, you know, the over WrestleMania they did this kind of a Mean Girls kind of storyline, you know, with the Bella twins and stuff, because they're maybe more traditionally in, you know, aesthetically pleasing to the eye, because, you know, their appearance, and so that was something they just banked on, and it was and it seems kind of again one of those gender stereotypes that women are catty and this is the way they are, and it's like, well, let's do some. I've seen TNA do some more interesting stuff. Total Nonstop Action, that promotion, they do some interesting stuff with their women wrestlers and give them a little bit more screen time and again, like ladder matches and really interesting stuff. That's like, whoa, they're hanging with the big boys. That's cool.
Right. But that reduction of female characters to these stereotypes of either cattiness or often it's over a guy.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in the WWE has the Total Divas show, which is a reality. Professional wrestling doing a reality show is like the funniest thing in the world.
No, and that's the thing. It's not wrestling anymore. It's become this transmedia behemoth.
It's but the WWE putting out anything that promotes or that claims to be real is quite entertaining to me. But but that show oftentimes boils down to either their relationships with male wrestlers, like romantic relationships, or their inner rivalries for airtime and championships and stuff. So even that show boils women's roles down to these very set stereotypes.
Sure.
And then I wonder, you know, if I have a daughter, do I want her watching that? Mm-hmm. I would say probably not. Mm-hmm. And two, if I have a son, do I want him watching that? Mm-hmm. And again, probably not, because I think it creates an unrealistic or even an unfair perception of women. Uh-huh. And given that the audience oftentimes is so young, does the WWE and other promotions not have some sort of a responsibility to that audience to break free from these stereotypes? Mm-hmm. And even if the results aren't real in that sense, to create more realistic characters?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, you bring up some good points, but yeah, I don't know if that's the goal. I mean, that's the thing. We'd have to, it'd be like, I don't even know if that's the goal.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
Like, you're right. It's like, oh, do I want, you know, my daughter to watch this product? You know, it's like, well, I'll probably have my daughter watch the WWE and just let her know, hey, this is, you know, this and that. But I probably won't buy my daughter a Barbie.
Right.
I think that's a whole lot more damaging, you know.
Right.
And that's something I can, you know, I think I can explain away wrestling a whole lot easier. It'd be like, well, look, it's not real, clearly, you know, because he's stomping him when he punches, so he can sound louder. So if that's not real, you know, the role of the woman is also not real, you know, so you have to understand that, you know. And so, yeah, I think the question, don't they have a responsibility, is the interesting one, and one that I don't have the answer to it, nor would I claim to. Yeah, it's a tough one.
It's not just women. It's too. I mean,
well, yeah. I did a presentation about specifically racial and ethnic stereotypes in wrestling, I've also done one on gender stereotypes in wrestling and stuff, but not, again, not focusing on the ones that are just these go-to kind of default placeholders of characters, but the ones that kind of defy that stuff. One of my favorites being Goldust, who initially came out as this this like transgendered character, you know, and kind of blurring the lines of masculinity and femininity, which was interesting, and a great feud against Val Venus, who was his character, was a former porn star.
Yeah.
And it just, what a good storyline that was, you know. And I thought they were doing some very interesting progressive stuff, you know, with that, because Goldust beat Val Venus and beat him with the Shattered Dreams, which is a kick to the groin and this emasculating thing, and so this transgendered kind of hyper feminine male character, you know, was emasculating the most hyper masculine guy on the roster, you know, and his virility and all this kind of stuff. I think those are more interesting, you know. I think you have to, unfortunately, I think you have to have that kind of baseline of those stock stereotype kind of gimmicks for those ones that subvert, to subvert that exact stereotype, you know, and Goldust being one of the most interesting ones, for just as an example.
Right, but even with Goldust, he comes out, when he first comes out, with a very well-endowed woman, and over time, it's clear, like, he's, at one point, I don't know why I remember this as vividly as I do, but he's asked one time by Jerry Lawler in an interview if he's gay, and he says no, and then punches him in the face. So it's still sort of, like, they still bring it back to this notion of what masculinity should be. And then they had that storyline of Billy and Chuck in the early 2000s, I think. These two guys, they're a tag team, and the notion is that they're also a couple.
Right.
And a lot of their storylines revolved around people basically just saying that they're not real men because of it. So, I mean, so it still comes down to these very negative portrayals.
I agree. But, I mean, I thought that, I mean, I think, I don't know, I guess maybe I just, at a certain point, I was able to kind of separate, you know, the real world and the wrestling world, because, like, maybe I'm okay with the, like, I'm very against, like, you know, racism, like, in the real world. I mean, I'm talking, like, legislation and politics and actual people being actually racist to other people and stuff like that. That's the stuff that concerns me as far as, like, race and ethnicity, as far as a true danger. And then in wrestling, I think, you know, because, again, because it's not real, you know, to bring it full circle, because it's a script and everything, and these people are playing the parts of a stereotype, that I think I've gotten to the point where I can separate that. I'm probably not, at this point, not your average wrestling viewer now, because of, you know, my research interests and all this other stuff. So certainly, you know, something like Billy and Chuck would be problematic if done, you know, in bad taste, you know. How interesting, you know, they were supposed to get married on the air, you know, like, how interesting would it be, like, if they got married and, like, had the support of the locker room, and, like, everybody would, like, that would be fascinating. That would be interesting. That would be something that would be an interesting storyline right now, for example, you know. And it's very topical, and wrestling is always topical, you know. What's going on in the news, wrestling's going to emulate that, you know. And I think it has a responsibility to do that. Does it drop the ball sometimes? Certainly, you know. So does music. So does television. Right. So does film.
Yeah, I guess. We shouldn't hold it to a higher standard than other forms of entertainment.
Right. And, like, we allow those, you know, we allow, you know, all sorts of racial and ethnic stereotypes all over any sitcom, all over any show that's a TV drama that's on, not even on cable, that's on NBC, ABC, something like that. And we accept that, you know. But then if wrestling does it, then it's bad, it's dangerous, and all this kind of stuff. And that kind of, and it, and that all comes from that demonizing the culture. A lot of it came from the 80s, too, with the steroid stuff. And I think there's still remnants of that that people are holding on to. And it's like, well, any jab I can get at wrestling, like, I'm going to take it. And I've gotten in those battles, you know, before, and having to defend this thing that I enjoy, and that to me is harmless and brings joy to my life. I like to be told a story every Monday, and I sit there and I put everything aside for a few hours and kind of check out, you know.
Although the wellness stuff is a legitimate concern. I mean, Dave Shoemaker, I mentioned before, he used to do a dead wrestler of the week, right? I mean, like these guys do seem to die rather young, and not just from steroids. I mean, substance abuse has been a major issue in professional wrestling for a really long time.
Yeah, it's actually often, I think, probably not I'd say bigger issues were probably going to be stuff like painkillers, muscle relaxers, yeah. things like that.
Yeah.
Again, to keep going, because they don't have an off season and stuff like that, you know, and their wellness policy and all this kind of stuff, you know, and making sure that's publicized that we're trying to take care of our wrestlers now and so on, and you know, but you know, I think it wrestling, unfortunately or fortunately, operates under different. Under different conditions than a true sport. You know, it's not going to be the same as baseball
right.
or mixed martial arts or football. Football's
right.
a big one. I think, I think the NFL is a whole lot more offensive than the WWE. I'll go on record and say that. You know, I think a lot of the stuff they do as far as their wellness policy or lack thereof, you know, it is dangerous. It's killing football players too, and that is in the news. So and stuff too, you know, and so the difference being that these wrestlers aren't actually competing for points and so on like these football players are. They're competing for viewership, competing for a spot on the roster, competing for, you know, me to buy that ticket to WrestleMania, you know, and so on. And that's where their impulse to use these things to keep going is to keep telling a story, you know. I think that's a tough one too. You know, it's an unfortunate byproduct of just the culture of wrestling. Just like, you know, football has a certain culture that does have to do with drugs also, you know, and wrestling has that too. You know, unfortunately, you know, it does have that, but. You know, they try to take measures to kind of minimize it, I think. But I think the reality of it is that it's there. It's probably there to stay.
Right.
You know.
Right, and they've been criticized for being late to it as well, as opposed to other, at least sports leagues. I mean, and Vince McMahon does make a very good point when he says that, you know, actors can go off and go do whatever, and they're entertainers, and no one really says too much.
Exactly.
Right. But I guess the difference is that for wrestlers, at least the ones who are under contract to him, there's some sort of a responsibility there. You would imagine that, I mean, if a actor has a contract with a studio, it would be the same thing. That there's some level of back and forth there. And it seems as though he has come around on this. But I think because they were so late to it, that has lingered and people view it with suspicion. And then you have people like Stone Cold Steve Austin now has his really successful podcast. He brings former wrestlers on and they tell their stories from the road.
Oh, yeah.
And they sit around and laugh about it.
Yeah.
Right? Which, okay, I mean, yeah, in retrospect, some of these things are funny, but you hear about what has happened and then you see what has happened to people like Jake Roberts or Scott Hall. Granted, they have sort of rebounded in their lives, which is good, but, I mean, those sorts of stories have contributed to, you know, killing guys and fragmenting families and have very negative impacts, and yet they're sitting around and laughing about it. And and so, you know, you talk about this culture, and yeah, there is a culture in football, and you know, the guys in the NBA in the 80s was all like cocaine and stuff, right?
Certainly.
Like, so these things did exist, but I don't know, it seems to me like wrestling hasn't had the same reaction from the top level to try and stamp it out with the same level of veracity that has existed elsewhere.
Right. And again, I come back to that. Well, the WWE is not the NFL. They aren't the MLB, nor are they trying to be. They are, you know, it'd be like a TV show, a TV show is going to start drug testing all the you know, cameramen and the actors and the sporting actors and so on. It's like, well, why would they? They're just entertaining people, you know.
Right.
And if they're gonna, you know. What you're gonna say, you know, tell me like, actors don't do drugs, you know, like, you know, that, you know, that's not true.
Yeah.
And stuff,
and actors tell stories too.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Kelsey Grammer, Charlie Sheen, like these guys will tell stories about what they used to do.
And it's interesting you bring up the, you know, Jake the Snake and Scott Hall. You know, those were the next two guys that everybody, you know, it's like you could almost start placing bets, which is the next wrestler that's gonna go, and a lot of people would put their money on those two guys, and so. That's become this narrative outside of the wrestling world now that is still part of wrestling. Wrestling is not just what happens in the ring now, you know. Like, now there's this narrative of these guys that were these kind of fallen heroes and so on, and they were at the, you know, really, you know, abusing themselves through alcohol and drugs and things like that, and then now they're on the rebound, and they're getting healthy, and, like, that's, like, a thing now, And so that, and that's new. That's so new. Like that, we haven't heard that story.
No.
That's a fascinating one. No. You know, I met Jake the Snake over in San Antonio last year. A really stand-up guy. And I told him, I was like, hey, I got back problems, man. And I started using that DDP yoga too, and it's making me feel better. And he gave me a big hug. And he was just a sweet dude.
Right.
And I'm like, how interesting, you know, like this. And I was like, this is a real moment. This isn't Jake the Snake Roberts. This is this guy, a real person.
Yeah.
Like, and it was interesting, really interesting, you know, so. Yeah, it's one of those. Yeah, the it's always heartbreaking to hear another wrestler passing. You know, it's you know, now, like I said, I've worked with these guys. I've worked with some of these. I've worked with, you know, wrestlers on the independent circuit. You know, and it's like these guys could get hurt in the ring too. You know, and just a few weeks ago, we you know, you get the news of El Hijo del Perro Aguayo in Mexico passing away in, you know, in the ring in this
from
really
a kick, right?
In a really tragic way, and you know, and an accident, a very freak, as freak accident as you can get. You couldn't be in the ring with a better technician than Rey Mysterio. Like, he is a very good veteran wrestler, you know. I remember my father and my little brother, we would go to Mexico and we would see Perro Aguayo. The father, we would see the we saw him. He was like the Ric Flair of Mexico. We would go check him out and this and that, and then to see that, you know, his son, you know, the top heel in Mexico. Like, I put him like on the level of a Randy Orton, you know.
Okay.
And you see him, you know, die in the ring, and he wasn't, you know, super huge and everything. You know, don't know if he was doing anything as far as drugs, but he wasn't killed by drugs as far as we know. We saw it happen, and it was through a physical action, you know, and so, and that's as big of a tragedy as anything else, you know. And so, yeah, it's all, it always sucks to get that news, you know. And then you're online, and all your wrestling buddies are, and it's like, people don't even get that, you know. Like, Eddie Guerrero died. I was a mess. I'm wearing my El Paso shirt. Nobody can see this, but I'm wearing a T-shirt with Texas on it that says El Paso. I'm from El Paso, like my home. When Eddie Guerrero passes away, like, I almost even felt like I couldn't even mourn properly. Like, well, people were allowed to mourn, like, John Lennon, you know? People were, like, if your favorite musician died, your favorite actor died, you know, Robin Williams, what a tragedy. That broke me, too, on the same level, you know? But it's like, I almost felt like I couldn't even mourn properly because, like, well, this is somebody I looked up to. This is something that meant something to me.
Yeah.
He's actually a hometown boy. Like, I have all these weird connections to him. He's Latino. He's Mexican-American. It's great. I am, too. He's finally that character that I saw who was us on TV. And he passes away in this tragic way. And again, because of the stigma around wrestling, this negative stigma, I even felt that, like, man, I can't even mourn the same way somebody else could mourn one of their entertainers because he's a wrestler.
Right.
And that's strange.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah.
You know?
It is a there is this really weird stigma. And even for you to say that, I find it really interesting because you are from Texas. And, I mean, I grew up in southern Ontario. So it strikes me that there's a much stronger wrestling culture in Texas, because so many major guys have come out of Texas. Right, the Von Erichs are from Texas.
Yeah,
Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, just guys from sort of who I know.
Yeah.
And even before then, the Texas wrestling scene has always been big. And you mentioned like Rey Mysterio and this the Lucha Libre Mexican style, which also exists. You know, these guys come to Texas and and wrestle
we get
a lot
that all the time.
And so for you to say that, I find that really interesting because coming from a place where wrestling is more common for people and that you still felt that way is really interesting.
Right, even in wrestling country, you're gonna still have this negative stigma, unfortunately. And you bring up an interesting point about you know, Texas having a wrestling culture. You know, Texas has its own wrestling culture. You can even get more specific. You know, San Antonio has a wrestling culture. Where I go down to Laredo and referee, Laredo has a wrestling culture. It's on the border. You know, it's kind of American wrestling. But with a little bit of lucha elements, maybe because of just proximity and the people that are coming over to work your shows and so on. And then you go over to the East Coast, you go out to Philly, the old ECW arena, you go there and you're going to get a different crowd. Wrestling over there is way different. Chicago has a different wrestling style. Canada has a whole different story. Puerto Rico and so on, you know. And so, again, you get these other little pockets that have their own, their own subculture within the wrestling world. That operates under different parameters, you know?
Right, and it sort of harkens back to the old territorial days.
Right.
Where each there was basically a wrestling organization for each part of the country.
Right.
And guys would go to a territory for a time, go to another territory, and but there were definitely stylistic differences between each territory.
Right, right. And it's like, oh, you got to learn how to work big men. You got to go over to New York, you know, or you got to be a little bit quicker. You go down to Mexico for 6 months, you know, or you got to learn some, you know, good submissions. You got to learn good fundamental mat wrestling that looks like catch wrestling. You got to go to Canada, you know. If you really want to work your chops, you got to go over to Japan, go to Puerto Rico, you know. Right. And so that's always fascinating to hear about, you know, and that's one thing we get through a podcast now, which is really cool, through all these different wrestlers interviewing current wrestlers, former wrestlers, and talking about those things. And so bringing this bigger view of what wrestling is and can be to the masses is a really cool thing. I think the whole podcasting thing has really added another layer to wrestling that helps people like myself, people like you, that maybe doesn't watch all the time, but you're interested in the storytelling aspect maybe. Yeah. And so it's really become more than just what's going on in the ring. It's really cool.
Sure. For sure. So now I do want to talk about your refereeing, because this is really interesting to me, because what you talked about yesterday was refereeing. I did not realize until I saw you today, because I couldn't go to the presentation yesterday. I did not realize that you were doing this from a first person perspective. Yeah. I assumed that you were just studying the referee, because, I mean, the referee, Jerry Seinfeld has a bit about how being a wrestling referee has to be the easiest job in the world, because you're like, hey, you want to hit him with a chariot? Go ahead.
Do whatever you want. I don't know that bit. I would love that. I love Jerry Seinfeld. Like,
you're a referee in a sport with no rules, basically.
Right, right.
Right. But the referee really is an integral character in the story. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, it has to do with the referee's back being turned or getting knocked down.
Right. Oftentimes,
In the story, are like the weakest guys in the world.
Well, when you're supposed to be, right? That's what you remember. Yeah. That's what I'm going to point out. That's what you remember, Sean. So, like, and that's really a good astute observation you have there. That usually they're portrayed as like a bumbling idiot, right? Yeah. Basically, but then there's times. I mean, you've seen matches where the referee will disqualify somebody.
Yeah,
storyline, all that kind of stuff. But at that moment, he's playing the role of the official, doing what an actual official would do.
Right. Where they, like, grab the chair out of the guy's hands before he hits the other guy.
Right, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And so they have certain spots and stuff like that. And so I find that stuff really interesting. Mm-hmm. And so doing my wrestling research and all this kind of stuff, and at a certain point, I'll say this on the record, I have zero problem saying this. A lot of time, academics, they just stick too much inside their books. It's like, dude, get out of your books or something, you know? And it's like, okay, well, I like wrestling and all this and that. Like, and by chance, I got to be involved in a first-hand kind of way. The way it went down is I have a roommate. I was living in Austin at the time. I have a roommate. He had a friend, he's originally from Laredo, and he's like, oh, you know, you watch wrestling, you study wrestling, you write about wrestling. I have a friend down in Laredo. He does that. Like, you should add him on Facebook, as it were, you know? Add him on Facebook, exchange a few messages, it's all cool. He comes up to Austin, we go to 6th Street one time, and all this, so we hang out, we get to know each other. And one day, he sends me a Facebook message with a link to YouTube of one of his matches, and he's like, hey, check out one of my matches. Give me some feedback, whatever you can. Mm-hmm. I gave him like 6, 7, 8 pages of notes, something ridiculous. Like, you know, deconstructing the match, like move for move and every arc. Just being, you know,
being an academic.
Being an academic, overdoing it. It's like, okay, I'm not going to put my toe in the water. I'm going to dive in. And so, and one of my observations was that I was like, I think your referee could be better. He's actually distracting because he's kind of out of position. He doesn't look the part. He looks kind of sloppy. His shirt's not tucked in. Sorry, I'm going to be honest. He asked me to be honest, so I was. His response, and jokingly, I said, I could do a better job. As it was completely joking, but as you know, sometimes when you text somebody or Facebook somebody, you lose that
meaning.
You don't
have the sarcasm font.
So he takes it as a literal. He's like, well, can you go get a T-shirt and come down to Laredo? And I was like, and I'm like halfway to the store, and I'm like, I text him back, yeah, I'll be right there, you know. I'll be there, you know. And so I went down to the local sports store, grabbed myself a referee shirt that fit. Got my, you know, black pants, black belt, black shoes, black socks. You know, I was like, if I'm going to do this, and they're going to let me. He's like, I'm going to talk to the promoter. Don't worry about it. Just come on down. And I'm like, if they're going to let me do this, I was like, I respect wrestling. I respect what these guys do. I can't do what they do. I have back problems. I can't be a wrestler, nor do I desire to. You know, I like to be the observer. But refereeing, I could be part of the show and be part of something that I value.
Right.
And so let me go down there. And so I go down there. It was really cool. The first show we did was they have an arena football team there in Laredo. And so they had the wrestlers do a promo during halftime, and our ring was set out in the parking lot. So okay. After the show, it was like everybody that came to the arena football show, you're invited to a free show for a five-star wrestling in Laredo. I'll go ahead and give that plug there. And so we get a pretty good crowd. This is like my first time doing this, you know. And get, you know, thrown into like a triple threat match and like the main event and everything, you know, stuff like, and just, you know, just like not the easiest of things, right. You know. And the promoter was also a wrestler, was in that match, and he's a heel, and he wins, and he throws the other two guys out of the ring, and he grabs me, and he just whispers to me, he's like, just roll out, and he just grabs me, and he throws me out of the ring, and so I roll out, like, I've seen it enough times, I'll figure it out, and right. So so it went on fine, and I was invited back. They're like, hey, really good job, like, you know what you're doing, cool, like, you know, right there for the counts, right there, he's a headlock, check for the choke, make sure it's a clean headlock, you know, count consistently, all those little things that a referee should do to play the role of the official. I'm not the official, I am playing the role of the official. You know, if the script says AJ is acting as the referee, right?
Right.
And it was tremendous, it was great, everybody was happy, everybody went home, and I felt the same satisfaction as when I finished writing a short story.
Yeah.
I swear to God, dude. Yeah. And I was like, cool. And then they invited me back. You know, first time they billed me as a special guest referee. The second time they billed me as a referee. By the third time I was there, they're like, senior referee, AJ Ortega, you know, because they liked how serious I took it. And because I value what they, again, I value what they do. Right. I respect all those guys that I've worked with. And they've all just accepted me into this strange fraternity, this strange brotherhood of people who are in this world, and we're all on the same page because we're all trying to tell a story and send the people home happy, you know. And it was really a good feeling. It's a good feeling, you know. And seeing that other layer of it firsthand, again, just heightened my the respect I already had for wrestling, was already striving for, just kind of skyrocketed,
right.
You know. And then you know, they would, you know, the guys would be excited, like, oh, you're gonna work my match, cool, you want to do a spot here, do this and do that, and they're like, oh, well, don't be afraid to put your hands on us, you know, like, you know, separate us from the corner, but you can be physical, like, oh, cool, you know. And they like that there's a referee willing to be that third man in the ring that's gonna propel the story forward, because think about it, it may seem simple, but you need the referee to construct meaning for the audience,
right?
The villain isn't a villain unless there's a referee there to stop him from doing villainous things,
right?
Otherwise, it's just two guys in the rings doing stuff.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, what's happening? Like, so you have to have that referee. Otherwise, you don't have a story.
You know,
you have to have that referee to construct meaning for the audience. And oftentimes, it's very overt pantomiming stuff. You know, like, oh, he's choking him. You do that. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4. He breaks at 4. You know, and you reprimand him. You get in his face and you wag your finger at him, and they love it. And they shove you out of the way, and then they keep on fighting. And and it's great, you know. And it's like, you know, and 5 minutes ago we were backstage talking about how we were going to do and how we're going to tell this story, and you know, and like, oh, how are your kids doing? How's work and stuff like that, you know. And then we're out there, and then, you know, playing our roles, and it's fun. I've never been an actor. Well, now I have. You know, I wasn't an actor. I'm not an actor by trade, but I've done a little bit of acting now. I've legitimately done some acting. It's interesting. Have been, you know, one match called for, you know, the referee to get knocked out at some point. I was like, oh, I wanted to work up to that, and so cool. And so I took a corner bump, you know, I was in the corner, out of position, somebody whips into me, and I get smashed in the corner. I fall down because the guy's bigger than me, obviously. Yeah. And so I fall down, and of course, you know, there's interference while I'm knocked out, of course. Yeah. And then I wake up conveniently to make the three count for the bad guy. You know, so, and everybody, and just to hear everybody boo, oh my God, you know, it's great. Yeah. We got the reaction we wanted.
Right, yeah, you want them to boo, yeah.
Yeah.
I've often thought that, like, bad guy wrestling manager is, like, the greatest job in the world.
It could be.
Because your job is to come in and, like, hit somebody with a chair.
Yeah.
Or, like, to go into the crowd and be like, hey, everybody, it's Philadelphia. The Phillies suck. Like, that's your
basically.
Job. Like,
cheap heat, as
you
call it.
Yeah, just, to me, that's, like, getting negative reactions would be so much fun. But the other thing that the and you say, like, the suspension of disbelief. I mean, we have to suspend disbelief. Like, Earl Hebner, who was, like, the main referee for the WWE for a long time, if he was actually as incompetent as his character was,
he would never be a referee.
He would never be a referee, right? He would have been fired 87 times.
So
the referee does have to have this sort of bewildered thing for the crowd, but they also, from what I understand, are integral to the match in terms of the communication between the wrestlers.
Yeah, I think maybe that happens a little bit more so. Well, I guess it's just going to depend on who you're working with.
Right.
But in my experience, let's say in the independent circuit down in Laredo for Five Star when I work for them, when I go down there, they usually have their stuff figured out, and I just let them know. They're like, oh, well, so-and-so's going over with a super kick. And so that's just kind of what I look out for. Everything else, I just do the pantomime and be where I need to be. And everything in the middle, they kind of fill in, and they kind of improvise or whatever. But there has been times where I've worked with a wrestler, you know, and he's, say he's downed in a corner, and the other guy's off on the other end of the ring, and he kind of motions over to me to come over, like very discreetly, that the crowd doesn't tell he's kind of, you know, nodding me over, and I go down there, pretend I'm checking on him, and he's like, hey, tell so-and-so, who he's fighting, tell so-and-so, tell my adversary to come over here, give me two clotheslines and then a shoulder block, you know. Okay, so, and then you go over here, and you go to the other guy, you pretend to reprimand him or something, but you're actually communicating him.
Right.
You're saying, hey, he wants to give you two clotheslines and then hit the ropes and give a shoulder bump. And they'll do it and stuff. And then, and then afterwards they'll be like, oh, thanks a lot for helping me out with that spot. You know, it's like, cool, you know, and it's very, you gotta, as a referee, if they want to utilize you, you got to be thinking on your toes. And I think, you know, some of the guys realize that, hey, okay, AJ is aware. He knows what's going on, so we can utilize him in this way. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes the referee is just there just because you need to have a referee, and they just get somebody to put their shirt on. I've seen independent shows where they aren't very professional. You know, that's why I like working for Five Star, that they like that, oh, AJ's being professional as a referee, and it lends something to our product that we're trying to do. I've seen some other promotions where it's like, dude doesn't even have stripes on his shirt, you know?
Right.
It's like, how are you supposed to be a referee? It's like, you're not an undercover cop. Like, I need to see your uniform, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, and you don't, with very few exceptions, you don't want to be wearing shorts. You don't want to be wearing jeans. You want to wear, you want to look the part. In some way, you have to look official, right?
Yeah.
You know, turn on the UFC. Their officials all wear the same uniform. They got the black shoes, black pants, black shirt, and so on. And, you know, and because they have to look the part, you know.
Right.
You have to look the part. Like, that's how I know you're the official, not just some dude off the street. You know? And it seems like this very simple, like, costume thing, but that's what wrestling, again, got to go back to theater. Got to go back to theater. If I don't look like a referee, I'm not a referee, and the crowd won't buy it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And which is the most important thing, is that buy-in. Although I have to say, I really liked it when the WWE, back when it was the WWF, used to have the referees in bow ties.
That was
always fun, to replicate the boxing look.
No, yeah, it was really cool.
I always enjoyed that.
The blue shirt with the little bow tie and stuff like
that. That was always fun. It always seemed so out of place.
Really interesting. And then a SmackDown for a while, they had like blue shirts. They had blue polos.
With the logo.
A blue polo with a logo, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, you go old school with the referee
classic
stripes, like that. You look like an official. You look like an official that's on the sideline of the NFL. You look like an official that's, you know, on a basketball court, you know.
Right.
And so, again, it's not a legitimate sport, but we're trying to maintain the illusion that it's a legitimate sport, so we borrow from legitimate sports.
Right, yeah, that suspension of belief.
Suspension of belief.
I can believe this guy is a referee because he looks like one.
Right.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah, and even looking the part, like right now, I usually wear a beard, and so when I referee, I shave, and I look like I'm, you know, I have shaved 10 years off me, you know, because you don't want to look more masculine than the wrestlers. You know, a lot of wrestling is about hyper masculinity and these big, scary looking tough guys and everything. I'm not a big dude, and like when I shave, I look just like a referee, you know.
And so
even that is a little thing that, like, I'm like, oh, here we go. And like, I gotta shave for just so I can look the part, you know. That's how serious it's a silly little thing, but like, whatever I can do to make it look good, whatever I can do to send the people home happy, whatever I can do to help this promotion that's invited me in and given me this tremendous experience, you know, and the satisfaction of being part of something that's bigger than yourself, is just invaluable, you know. I've been so busy with work, I can't get back down there. I'd want to. Maybe this summer I'll have a chance to again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's really cool, and I think what you're doing is really interesting. You said, and I don't know if a lot of people know how this at least listeners of this show, how this conference is set up, but it's set up by area. So when you submit your abstract, as opposed to like the CHA or other conferences, you just submit it to the central registry. Here you apply to a specific area.
Right.
And next year you're saying you're hoping that you get a wrestling area.
Yeah, that's kind of
our
goal.
Or in the next year or two.
Yeah,
or
in the future, that's my goal. You know, when I started coming to this conference and trying to find, like, okay, I'm saying smart things about wrestling. Where do I say this? Like, what's the home for this? And so I found a home at the Popular Culture Association Conference. So initially, I started off like in a television kind of the area. I would present there, and then found my way through a friend who also wrote about wrestling in the theater area. We kind of hooked up there, and so now we do it all in the theater area. And we had two wrestling panels this year, and so I think there's enough buzz, and then there's enough people interested and excitement around it where I think we need to remove ourselves from the theater area. And I want to start an area just for wrestling studies, and we'll have a home here. Because there's a bunch of fascinating things here. You know, there's the science fiction stuff, the comic book stuff, theater stuff, television, film. Anything that's pop culture is represented here. And it's a cool conference for me because I just love when people say smart things about certain genres of art that people may not think you could say smart things about, you know? And it's like, well, everything deserves to be studied at a certain point, you know, I think, if you do it right. And so, I'm hoping that we can have our own kind of wrestling studies kind of a cohort that kind of, you know, has a home here at the PCA.
Yeah, no, that would be really cool. And in the meantime, if people want to sort of look up your stuff, what's the best way for them to do that?
Oh, sheesh. Best way to look up my stuff?
Just Google you?
Yeah, you could just Google my name, AJ Ortega. Yeah. You can even, anybody can shoot me an email. It's ajortega@gmail.com. I'm completely fine with that, too.
Okay.
And so there'll be a website going up soon and stuff like that. This is kind of a formative year for me on my creative writing side and my academic side. I'm trying to make a lot of moves and stuff and surrounding myself with the right people. Met a lot of good people here at PCA that are into wrestling. And again, coming at it from different angles. You know, I come at it from a writer. Mm-hmm. We have all sorts of other people coming at it from different angles. And, you know, I was always told, you know, smart people surround themselves with people that are smarter than them. And so I'm always like, okay, where are these people that are saying smart things about wrestling? And so now I've kind of, you know, got a good pool of them together, and we're kind of making moves now. So
And I'll link, when I post this, we'll link to the papers that you've done on wrestling. So AJ Ortega, University of Houston at Victoria, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks so much, Sean. It was a pleasure, and good luck with your podcast in the future. I'm going to be a listener, subscribed, and all that kind of stuff.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Questions and comments for the podcast is historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for him.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.